Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is podcast number 69 for Tuesday, September 28th. I'm Ben Snitkoff, and with me today I've got...
Dominic Rabbi.
And that's it. We're an abbreviated panel this week. David O'Brien is stuck doing some work, and David Liu is missing in action after recently returning from a summer working for a large media company out in California. I don't know if we ever mentioned which company he was working for over the summer, but...
I don't believe we did.
Okay.
And we probably shouldn't without his permission.
Yeah.
So.
We'll keep the wraps on that. Yeah, if you really want to know, I'm sure he'd be willing to tell you. But anyway. We've got three stories for you, like we tend to do. Three exemplary stories, Dominic. Let's give them the credit that's due. Yeah. The three stories this week are, first, T-Mobile being sued over blocking certain third-party traffic through text messaging. Second, we've got Apple initiating a lawsuit against a third-party manufacturer of external batteries because they were allegedly infringing on Apple's patents on the MagSafe connector. And finally, we've got the second round of a lawsuit between Georgia Pacific, which is a company that makes paper towels and paper towel dispensers, and companies that are shipping out these paper towel dispensers and supplying non-Georgia Pacific paper towels for them. The scandal. So our first story is this T-Mobile lawsuit. And to give you guys a little background, a company called Easy Texting, which provides a wide range of third-party services. Essentially, these mobile updates, you know, you sign up for something and you can either get information by texting to them and then they'll text you information back, or they'll push you text updates and, you know, for a small fee. This company provided several services through T-Mobile, including one that would allow people to find legal marijuana dispensaries in California. T-Mobile blocked off Easy Texting's access to the T-Mobile network, and Easy Texting sued in federal court, asking the federal court to enjoin T-Mobile from continuing to block Easy Texting. Now, last we heard, the court declined to initiate a preliminary injunction, but there is a hearing set for Thursday, September 30th, so obviously as we get more information about that, we'll keep you guys apprised. So, Dominic, what are your initial thoughts on this story? You know, do they have a cause of action just because T-Mobile won't let them have access to their network?
Honestly, not sure. I mean, technically, it's a private network, right?
Yes, and I think the interesting question here is whether or not common carrier provisions that do apply to things like telephony and even, to some extent, wireless networks, do those still apply to texting?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if anyone knows yet, honestly.
Yeah, and one way to look at this is to actually consider another side of the net neutrality. You know, this isn't precisely information going over an internet, but it is information going over these networks that are owned by third parties, and whether or not these third parties should have or do have the right to decide, and Easy Texting is alleging on a content basis, whether or not something is allowed to go over that network. And that's really, I think, what has people so worried about this lawsuit, that T-Mobile is making a content-based decision. Now, T-Mobile has a different idea of what's going on. Dominic, could you explain a little bit what their position
sure.
is?
Basically, their point of view is they've got these, they have a T-Mobile playbook, they call it, and also there's this long... very long PDF, effectively called the, let me get the exact title, U.S. Consumer Best Practices Guidelines for Cross-Carrier Mobile Content Programs, published by the Mobile Marketing Association. It's like pages and pages and pages of fun stuff that says, any reference to the abuse of alcohol, drugs, or tobacco or other controlled substances is strictly prohibited. This includes verbal or nonverbal actions in which a person could conclude that the promotion of drug use is intended. Basically saying all these sort of regulations for each of the major networks.
Yes, and not only that, there are different regulations for certain networks. So some things may be allowed on one network but are disallowed on another network. And this is all laid out in this 140-some-odd page document.
Right, and basically the T-Mobile says, hey, you didn't follow our rules, so we blocked your text messages. And these rules are carefully laid out in this very large document.
Right. Easy Texting, however, fired back, and they said, well, T-Mobile's statement, and I'm quoting here, is inconsistent with reasons that were communicated to Easy Texting when T-Mobile began its unlawful blocking. They're claiming that, you know, T-Mobile is stepping out of this. You know, the reason why Easy Texting is claiming that T-Mobile is blocking them is not the reason that T-Mobile is claiming it. And T-Mobile actually said in their statement about this that, you know, they came out and said that we were blocking them because they weren't complying with these guidelines that are very free and open and public and everyone has access to and shouldn't be surprised to anyone. Furthermore, T-Mobile said, we normally don't comment on these things, but we just felt we had to. I'm a little reluctant whenever reluctant to believe a company whenever they come out and say, like, listen, we don't normally comment on ongoing litigation, but we will here to make us look better. The credibility is... Their reasons for saying that have to be, I don't know, questioned. You don't have to necessarily disbelieve them, but it's kind of hinky when they come out and make a statement like this when they normally wouldn't. Do you know what I'm getting at?
No, absolutely. It's like, well, if you normally don't comment, why are you commenting now?
Yeah, it's kind of like, so in evidence, if... A party to your in the rules of evidence, if you're in a lawsuit and the opposing party says something that could hurt them in the lawsuit, you can pretty much get that in at trial regardless of whether or not it was hearsay, because there's an exception to it. And it seems like one of those things where they're coming out and specifically saying something that supports their position to kind of like I don't even know how to. It's like they're putting on a false front here. They could just sit back and say nothing, but instead they come out and, you know, defend their honor to put out a an excuse to the public. It makes me wonder whether or not this is just trying to get the public back on their side.
Yeah, I don't know if you actually mentioned this in your introduction to the story, but the content of the text messages. So Easy Texting is basically their text messaging marketing company, and one of their clients was legalmarijuanadispensary.com. And so they were sending these text messages regarding the location of legal marijuana dispensaries using the easy texting marketing service to people on the T-Mobile network. And T-Mobile network basically blocked them. And what I understand, the way it works is people opt in to receive messages from Easy Text Messaging by sending what's called a short code to basically say, all right, I accept messages from this provider. And so all their marketing is tied to one short code. In other words, they could be representing other things apart from the legal marijuana dispensaries, but it's all like you opt into all messages from Easy Texting at once by sending the short code. And so T-Mobile basically turned off that and said, okay, well, we're unopting everyone out.
Right. And Easy Texting's position the entire time has been that the blocking is over this particular client and not other clients, the legal marijuana dispensaries. From what I understand, they were just giving out location information and were not in any way advocating drug use. But I mean, at the same time, if, you know, I'm asking you where a guy could buy drugs and you tell me, it's hard to take that as not advocacy of drugs.
Right. And the weird thing is that T-Mobile says that Easy Texting had not followed the process of the 140-page PDF for weed maps, as the service was oddly called. But then the next sentence says the content of the weed map service had nothing to do with T-Mobile's decision. And honestly, that simply really makes me wonder.
Right. Right. Like, because if you could block it based on the content, based on those guidelines, why wouldn't you come out and say that? It's not like they're a governmental entity and that they have to worry about trampling on people's free speech rights.
Right.
You know, they can block, well, assuming they have the ability to block people over, for any reason, they would also be able to block people because of content.
Yeah, I mean, back in the early days of internet ISPs, Progeny, one of the early competitors to AOL, advertised itself as a family-friendly ISP, and they said, we will curate or try to make sure that you can't get to bad content on the internet, and we will try to block stuff for you, and that's one of the features of Progeny. That's why you should use us, because we'll keep your family safe online. I wouldn't be surprised to see something similar perhaps emerge as sexting continues and that sort of stuff, with people saying, hey, we'll curate your text messages. We'll make sure that your children aren't exposed to anything, blah. So,
yes, I mean, because children should be protected from all things blah.
Yes, their lives should be entirely exciting all the time. So yeah, you're absolutely right that they don't have, like, this isn't a First Amendment issue, but the net neutrality, again, is this part of the internet? Is texting part of the internet? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either, and this is definitely something that we're going to have to keep an eye on as it moves forward. I guess because there are only two of us, we may make this podcast a little shorter than our other ones, and unless you have any further thoughts about this, Dominic, I'm willing to move on to the next story. You?
Yeah, I think, I mean, we've pretty much said all that we can think of. We don't have David O'Brien here to give us a long, detailed legal analysis. So.
Take it away.
All right, so our next story involves Apple, one of the companies that probably features among the most on our podcasts. I think Apple and Google are definitely up there. We should actually do some statistical analysis at some point. But anyway.
I'll let you do that statistical analysis.
So Apple filed a lawsuit against Sanho Corporation, which make HyperMac external batteries, and more importantly, they also make product line stuff that basically they make. The HyperMac brand doesn't just use or isn't just batteries, it's also batteries that let you charge, say, your iPad or your MacBook using Apple's 30-pin connector design and Apple's MagSafe connector design. What these are basically the things that you plug into your computer to or your iPad to charge it and keep it happy, full of battery life, and not dead. They come in two flavors. One, which is your standard 30-pin, which is just a metallic-to-metallic interface. No magnetism involved. You just plug the socket into the socket and it sticks. And the other one is Apple's patented MagSafe design, which basically uses a magnet so that if you accidentally trip over your cord, you won't send your iPad flying, but the cord will just nicely detach, and you won't have to extricate your iPad from the wall. So,
oh, just to clear something up, the iPad doesn't use the MagSafe. The 30-pin is the standard.
30-pin is the iPad one, yeah. And the MagSafe iPad, is the one on the MacBook, sorry.
Right. iPad, iPhone, yeah. iPod is 30-pin, and then all the laptops right now are MagSafe.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. It is important. So your MacBook won't end up in the wall. There we go. So basically, Apple actually does license people to use the 30-pin one, the one that's for iPads, iPhones, that sort of things. But it doesn't license the magnetic one that is used for MacBooks. So what Sanho actually did was they were like, all right, well, you know what? We don't want to get a license because licenses from Apple are expensive. What we're going to do is we're just going to buy old MagSafe connectors and 30-pin connectors and then rework them into our product. So instead of manufacturing the 30-pin connector ourselves from scratch or manufacturing the MagSafe connector from scratch, we'll go find old ones, buy them, and work them into our product. The reason they did this is because there's something called patent exhaustion, which is basically an extension of the first sale rule. What it basically means is if you have a patent, you can only control the first sale. The patent only allows you to sell, only allows you to basically have that exclusionary right up to the first sale. So if I patent a design for a, or if I patent a novel invention of a pen, I can control who can sell that pen initially. But once that pen is sold, I can't stop people from reselling the pen. That's the first sale doctrine in a nutshell, effectively. So what Sanho is doing is they're saying, hey, we're reusing Apple's old parts. Apple made these connectors. We didn't. Since Apple made them, they can't be violating or infringing patents because Apple can't infringe its own patents. We're just using, we're a secondary market. So we're just giving these things a new life. Apple disagrees with this and it decided to take Sanho to court. So that's the essence of the story. Any thoughts on which way it'll go or any other insights, Ben?
Well, first thing I want to mention is that we talked about the first sale doctrine in the context of copyright a couple of weeks ago on Podcast 67. And in that discussion, we came across the fact that the first sale doctrine can be the first sale doctrine in copyright. And sometimes it's called first sale and sometimes it's called patent exhaustion in patent. Interesting note about that I can get to later. In copyright, it can be contracted around. So in Werner v. Autodesk, in that case, the original purchaser of Autodesk agreed to a very restrictive license, and that diminished their ability to resell the copyrighted item afterward. Similarly, in the patent arena, even if I buy a patented device, in the sale contract it says it can only be used once, and then it has to be returned to the company for refurbishing if you want to use it again, you'll have the same problem. That you can, you know, make a contract that kind of abridges your first sale or patent exhaustion rights that you would otherwise have. It is worth noting that a couple of years ago now, there was a case, LG v. Quanta, in the Supreme Court, which kind of reaffirmed patent exhaustion or the first sale doctrine as a thing in patent law. So unlike in copyright law, where the first sale doctrine is actually codified, in patent law, it is not. It was a judicial creation, basically an extension of copyright. A case came across the desk of the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court took a look at it and said, you know what, we think that the first sale doctrine as it applies in copyright should also apply to patent law. And since then, Congress has had many opportunities to get rid of it in patent if they wanted to, and they have not. And just a couple of years ago now, as I mentioned, the Supreme Court reaffirmed that the first sale doctrine does exist in patent law still. So that being said, I think this is a really interesting case. And if what this company says is true, that they are not recreating them and that they are using genuine Apple MagSafe connectors, and from looking at their website, I mean, they look absolutely genuine. They look like the real thing. Then I think they've got a very good claim that this is not copyright infringement. I'm sorry, this is not patent infringement on their part. That, you know, Apple's the one tariff that Apple is entitled to on their patented items has expired because they sold it once, and then they lose control over it.
If that's true, but and Apple's complaint alleges infringement. So if there's even one that they made themselves and didn't reuse, then they could be liable for infringement.
Yeah, but in that case, they'd be liable for one count of infringement, right. Not hundreds and hundreds and hundreds.
That's true.
Right. Wow. The other thing that's worth noting is the LG v. Quanta case that I mentioned also says that, say there's a process patent that's integrally tied to the device, that basically if you use the if you are to use the device, you have to use the device in the realm of this process patent. Like, to take a really simple example, say I patent a spoon, and the process patent I get along with this device patent is for moving food or sustenance into your mouth by first, you know, a series of steps consisting of putting the spoon in the food, taking the spoon out of the food, lifting the spoon into your mouth, and placing the spoon in your mouth. You pretty much have to use a spoon like that. I mean, maybe you can put it into somebody else's mouth. We'll say we claim that anyway.
Well, actually, technically, you use the word consisting of, which means that you only claim those steps exactly and not any additional steps. So I could avoid your patent by inserting a step in the middle, for example. That didn't do that.
I thought, oh, so
comprising.
I wanted
open
to say
one.
Comprising.
Yeah. You actually started saying compry, but then you started. Anyway.
Yeah. That's fine.
Trivia detail.
Yeah. I was going through that in my head, and I thought I picked the right one, but yeah. Anyway, as I was saying, the first sale doctrine also encompasses that process patent. So once Apple loses their right to enforce the device patent on that, they would also lose their right to enforce that, you know, integrally related process patent. So if they were trying to, the moral of this story is, if they were trying to get around this by claiming, you know, we're not saying that they're infringing on our device, the MagSafe connector, we're saying that they're infringing on the process of using the MagSafe connector, that probably wouldn't fly either.
Yeah. They are alleging infringement of the utility patent, the design patent. Let's see here.
The design patent would be an interesting claim.
Yeah.
Because, I don't know, my guess is because design patents are generally so much like trademarks that you'd come into the same exhaustion problem, that if it's a genuine Apple connector, then Apple would have lost the trademark right, the design patent right at that same time there.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the images of the design patent, and it looks like they're claiming just the connector.
Yeah, that would make sense. Otherwise, they're, the chargers are pretty generic. They look like right. bricks with apples on them.
Yeah.
And the Apple's already trademarked, so it'd be kind of redundant to get a design patent on that.
Yep. So, it'll definitely be interesting to see how this case turns out, just because, I mean, let's say that Sanho is basically doing what they said they're doing. They aren't manufacturing themselves. Can Apple basically... It doesn't seem to me that Apple would be able to get around the first sale doctrine patent exhaustion.
I would agree. I don't see how they would be able to do that. I mean, they could always make new law and surprise everyone, but I'm with you in that it seems like this company has a very good defense in the first sale or patent exhaustion doctrine.
And Apple, interestingly, isn't attempting to use some sort of end-user license agreement or some sort of, oh, when you bought your MacBook, you said you couldn't give away your cable or sell it to anyone.
At least if they are trying to do that, they have not pled it in their complaint.
Yeah, so, which would be an interesting issue if they had, like whether they that sort of thing could be enforceable. Can you restrict someone's for sale rights via a license when they're purchasing a product from you instead of just licensing a product from you? I think the answer is probably no, because it's a tangible product, right?
Right. Incidentally, I think I'm one of the bigger Apple fanboys on this podcast, and I'm not happy about this lawsuit. These people are making a very good product that fills a need that Apple is not filling in any way. As far as I know, there aren't any other companies even that make external batteries. Apple has made no effort to fill this void. It's just kind of un-Apple-like. They're not. It doesn't even seem like there's any spite to go after somebody here, like you've seen in some recent Apple suits. They're just doing it.
Apple, though, doesn't like other people making stuff that they don't want them to make, though. Like, Apple doesn't make an external battery and doesn't think you should need an external battery. Therefore, how dare you make an external battery, I guess?
What other cases have you seen where Apple's done something like that?
I'm thinking back in the early days of the Mac, they really restricted what people could do in terms of peripheral manufacturers and that sort of stuff.
Okay. I'll believe you. I don't have...
Or at least as far as I remember, or maybe I'm just thinking in terms of their whole, we are the manufacturer for the entire software and hardware, and unless we give someone our blessing, they can't add to our stuff.
Okay.
So it maybe it's just sort of the philosophical approach.
I mean, typically there's been the made for iPod program and the
not made for iPod program.
So, right. Yeah. And then, but there has been an ecosystem of not made for iPod, but still iPod compatible things that Apple. I mean, this is the first lawsuit I can think of that where Apple's gone after someone for making stuff that's compatible with their computers, but not licensing it.
Yeah, I think what might have annoyed them is that.
With the exception of the Power Macs or whatever the company that was making the compatible computers.
Right.
That was different. At least I would like to rationalize that it's different.
I think here Apple might be mad at Sanho for not getting a license for the 30-pin connector when they could have.
Even though
they were reusing it, they might have just been able to get a 30-pin connector.
Mm-hmm.
So get the license, and then Apple maybe wouldn't be... Well, it certainly would remove the iPhone and iPad aspect of the lawsuit and just leave us with the MagSafe.
Right. Okay.
So, yeah, Sanho Corporation's website says that for maximum compatibility, HyperMac charging cables are spliced with the original Apple MagSafe connectors. So...
Yeah. Assuming they're telling the truth on their website, which if they aren't, they've got... other
issues,
possibly more important issues than Apple suing them, like the Federal Trade Commission.
Yeah, it's interesting
that class action lawsuit.
Apple doesn't mention that in their complaint at all.
I would not mention that in my complaint if I were drafting the complaint.
Yeah, I guess you don't need to argue defenses if they're not raised. So argue against defenses
yeah,
if they're
well,
not.
Well, yeah, until they're raised at least.
Right. So.
Okay.
Okay.
Last story.
Go for it.
So this is a story that may sound familiar, and I'll get to why it may sound familiar in a second. So Georgia-Pacific, as I mentioned in the intro, is a company that makes, among other things, paper towel dispensers and paper towels. Now, they sell their paper towel dispensers to places with, you know, say, bathrooms, with the idea that these people will continue to buy Georgia-Pacific paper towel, and as a result... the paper towel dispensers have the Georgia Pacific brand and, you know, use a very specific sized paper towel that until recently Georgia Pacific was the only one who made. Another company comes along and starts making compatible paper towels, and these distributors that are distributing Georgia Pacific paper towel dispensers and paper towel also start distributing this less expensive compatible paper towel. Georgia Pacific brings at least two separate lawsuits that we've seen so far. The first one that we're going to just touch on briefly was in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. And what happened there is that the Fourth Circuit took a look at this case and said, oh, well, you know, if we take a look at this and the evidence that was introduced below, I think there could have been a likelihood of confusion that somebody who was using the Georgia Pacific paper towel dispenser could have thought that the Georgia Pacific paper towel dispenser contained Georgia Pacific paper towel, and that using some other company's paper towel in there would create a likelihood of confusion as to, say, the quality of Georgia Pacific paper towels. And as a result, Georgia Pacific should be able to recover. However, and the reason why we're talking about this now is because there is a Eighth Circuit decision that came down September 15th that came to, in some ways, the opposite conclusion. What this court said is they took a look at the judge's findings in the district court, and they said, well, in this case, the judge found that there wasn't a likelihood of confusion, and because the judge has some discretion in determining, you know, on the facts and the testimony that was before the judge, whether or not there was a likelihood of confusion, we're just going to affirm the judge. So what we have is a poor circuit split, but a circuit split at that between the Fourth and the Eighth Circuits as to whether or not there was a likelihood of confusion about when you're using a Georgia Pacific paper towel dispenser, whether or not it contains Georgia Pacific paper towels. I said Georgia Pacific a lot of times in that sentence.
Yes, you did.
Did you follow that? I feel like it may have gotten confusing at some point.
A little bit. I just want to clarify the distinction between the Fourth and Eighth Circuits. So the Fourth Circuit and the Eighth Circuit are appellate courts, so they hear stuff that comes from district courts. So it's heard by a district court first before it gets to either one. So in the Fourth Circuit, the district court there actually granted summary judgment saying that there's no contributory trademark infringement. There isn't. There's no case. Georgia Pacific loses, go home. Georgia Pacific appealed. The Fourth Circuit reversed, saying the grant of summary judgment for contributory infringement, trademark infringement, was incorrect, meaning that to say that there isn't a case here was wrong because there could be a case here. In the Eighth Circuit, the district court, it wasn't a summary judgment decision. It was a finding of no likelihood of confusion. And here the Eighth Circuit affirmed the district court, saying that the judge, it was actually a bench trial, so there was no jury, the judge did things correctly, there was no likelihood of confusion. So there's slightly different issues in that the Fourth Circuit is dealing with summary judgment, whether there could potentially be a chance of contributory trademark infringement, in which case summary judgment isn't appropriate.
Right.
And the Eighth Circuit is dealing with whether or not there was, in the facts before that judge, no likelihood of confusion, which, incidentally, is an element of contributory trademark infringement.
Right.
So that's sort of where the two intersect, in that one of these fits into the other. But I hopefully that clarified a little bit.
Yeah, it's a very interesting case, and it's... I mean, of all of the things for Georgia Pacific to be litigating here.
Yeah.
Really, essentially what they're trying to do is use trademark law to create what I think would otherwise be...
antitrust issues.
Yeah, an unlawful tying arrangement, saying that if you use our paper towel dispensers, you have to use our paper towels. You know, prototypical example of this is, you know, buying a salt machine that, you know, salts a driveway and saying that if you buy this salt machine, you absolutely have to buy this company's salt to go with it. You know, and in the old days, that would have been a slam dunk antitrust case. Nowadays, I mean, I think that a court would be reluctant to say it was a slam dunk and would still look at, you know, whether or not Georgia-Pacific had market power in the paper towel dispensers and whether or not they were trying to leverage that market power into the market for paper towels. But either way, it still seems like what otherwise would be an illegal tying is, at least in some ways, well, at least in the Fourth Circuit, being tacitly sanctioned by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals there.
Yeah, the Eighth Circuit actually, amusingly, goes to a great deal to talk about industry custom, and they go so far to say that it's a common and unobjectable and common practice to put towels of one brand of dispenser into a dispenser of one brand into a dispenser of a different brand. They're saying this happens all the time. They even affirm the district court's view, even though there was a survey showing that 23% of respondents using InMotion machines, Georgia-Pacific's machines, thought the brand of towel was Georgia-Pacific's, even though it might not have been.
That's a pretty low percentage.
That is a pretty low percentage.
A quarter of the people?
Yeah, but that's still, I mean, that's still confusion, right? But like, it wasn't very likely, apparently.
So. Yeah.
I mean, I honestly, before coming across this story, did not know that. I mean, I knew that paper towels were branded, but I never, you know, thought about the brand of the paper towel in the bathroom, if there's even paper towel in the bathroom.
Yeah. Let me tell you, millions of companies everywhere, after reading the Fourth Circuit decision, are probably going to be switching to that, like, Dyson Airblade, just to avoid, you know, any chance of being sued here. Have you ever used that thing? It's the one where you stick your hands in and it's like a really powerful jet of air on either side and you just draw your hands out and they're completely dry.
It actually works, you mean?
It's amazing.
As opposed to the terrible standard. Well, Dyson, is that the vacuum cleaner company?
Yeah, they have the vacuum
they know what they're doing, right?
Yeah, the bladeless fan.
Yeah, so it seems like they know what they're doing. So good, because like your normal hand dryers are absolutely terrible. They don't dry your hands.
Right.
Like you press the button, then you wait, and then you press the button, you wait, and then you're like, okay, screw this, I'm just going to wipe it on my jeans.
Right.
So, yeah. But it'll be interesting to see what happens over this quasi-circuit split. I'm not sure if I'd even go so far as to call it a circuit split.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
Not sure quasi-circuit split is also the right, I don't know what that would mean. But, yeah, to me it kind of feels slimy what Georgia-Pacific is trying to do, in that, like you said, they're trying to go around the antitrust things by using contributory trademark infringement. So I'm inclined to say that, no, bad, you shouldn't be doing that. That's not what contributory trademark infringement is for. But, I mean, if the law is written in such a way that they can do that, until Congress goes so far as to amend the law to prevent what they're doing, then the law is on their side, potentially.
Right.
So, assuming there is that confusion, so...
Yeah, and I've never heard of so there's copyright misuse, where you try to extend copyright law in a way that would violate antitrust law, and that's usually... That's a defense in most circuits to copyright infringement. Have you ever heard of a trademark misuse? Defense to a trademark lawsuit? Trademark infringement?
Trademark misuse. I haven't personally heard of anything.
I would totally argue it in a court. But, yeah, I agree. I've never actually heard of a case recognizing trademark misuse as a defense to trademark infringement.
Some quick Googling reveals on the Chilling FX website that the trademark misuse theory was recently employed, I'm quoting from that website, in challenging Network Solutions' dispute policy, which held that registered trademark holders had a right to have Network Solutions immediately freeze any allegedly infringing domain names until the dispute was settled. The argument went that the claims that had little or no support were being alleged by the registered trademark holders so as to prevent possibly infringing material sites from materializing, Basically, they're saying that they're overreaching what their rights give, since they aren't necessarily infringing, immediately quashing it just because they said they might be is misuse of trademark.
Oh, okay. So, there you go.
There's an example.
I guess it does exist to some degree. Okay.
Whether it would, I mean, whether that would, I mean, could they be overreaching here in terms of their trademark? Is their logo even on the paper towel? Like,
yeah, I would be shocked if it were. But I don't know. I can't claim to have ever paid
and if it's
that
not
close
on the paper
attention.
Towel, if it's not on the paper towel, then, I mean, let's say their logo is on the paper towel, then obviously the imitation paper towels don't have the logo, right? So there's no confusion.
Yeah, and if if neither of them have a logo, then I would say you've got a better argument for a risk of confusion or a likelihood of confusion, because then you're relying on, you know, I don't think, let me pull out a Kleenex here, I don't think my Kleenex has Kleenex branded anywhere on it, but the box does, and when I pull the Kleenex out of the box, I expect a Kleenex brand Kleenex, don't I?
Yeah, you do.
Okay.
Even though the Kleenex doesn't have Kleenex written on it. So.
Yeah, so similarly, I guess Georgia-Pacific is arguing when you take a paper towel, unbranded paper towel out of a Georgia-Pacific paper towel dispenser, you expect a Georgia-Pacific paper towel.
Sure. Although, as the Eighth Circuit says, the industry custom is such that dispensers and towels don't correspond.
Right.
And personally, I never even realized that the dispenser and the towel would have the same manufacturer. So.
Right, me neither. Yeah, okay.
Incidentally, this whole case is actually not suing the maker of the fake Georgia-Pacific paper towels that happened to fit into their custom dispenser, but a distributor, which is why it's contributory trademark infringement.
Right.
So.
Yeah, the person who's distributing the fake paper towels to people who it knows use Georgia-Pacific paper towel dispensers.
Or let me rephrase that. Sorry. The Eighth Circuit one is actually against the distributor.
No, so was the Fourth Circuit, I thought.
No, the Fourth Circuit is against the actual manufacturer.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So that's why it's contributory trademark infringement, because the manufacturer is trying to, basically, they're using the facts of your scenario that you expect a Georgia-Pacific towel. Therefore, they're contributing to trademark infringement by making something that rides on the good name of Georgia-Pacific.
Right. And the people who are actually committing the trademark infringement, by the way, are the people who are
putting in the towels in the dispenser.
Yes. But they're, you know,
there's
relatively
too many of them,
small
they don't
companies.
Have any money, so.
Yeah. They're what we call judgment proof.
Yes. Yeah. We're numerous and poor.
Yeah.
Have fun not suing us.
Yeah.
So.
Or rather, have fun suing us but not getting any money in exchange. Okay, Dominic, any last thoughts on this story?
All set.
As am I. So, in that case, I would like to thank you all for joining us. This has been the 69th episode of the Technically Legal Podcast. As always, you can head over to our website, www.technicallylegal.org, or email us, podcast@technicallylegal.org, if you have any suggestions, comments, story ideas. We're always excited to hear from our listeners. That being said... I'm Ben Snetkoff, and with me today was...
Dominic Rabier.
Thank you for joining us.